So in today's class, I'm going to finish off talking a little bit about the philosophy of realism versus anti-realism that we didn't get to last time. And then for most of the lecture, I'm going to introduce a toy model that is a bit like quantum theory, the goal of which is to show us what the advantages of having a realist and psi-epistemic model would be. Okay, so let me sort of review where we were last time. Last time we were talking about realism versus anti-realism. So as a reminder, realism is basically the idea that there exists an objectively real physical world independent of observers. Job of physics is to attempt to describe it, and we regard successful theories as approximately correct descriptions, a successive so each new successful theory is somehow a more correct description of the objectively real physical world. And then we contrast that with the anti-realist position, which has a variety of different names, but the point is that it starts from the idea that the only thing that we really have direct access to is our own perceptions, or perhaps more objectively, the records of results of experimental procedures. And so theories, since they don't, you know, so the bedrock is our direct perceptions, and then theories are simply some kind of system for organizing regularities in those perceptions and results. This leads us to the idea that theoretical entities, electrons, for instance, or perhaps more importantly for our kinds of considerations, things like quantum states, of course, are just going to be a convenient fiction which we use in our calculation to organize those regularities. In a particular variety of anti-realism, one that sort of plays a role in what we're doing is operationalism. This is the idea that every statement of a theory should boil down to just a list of instructions for what to do in the lab and what will be seen as a result. So the idea is that you could write out sort of a manual, a clear instruction manual, for any statement in a physical theory that would reduce it down to just statements of what to do and what you observe. Okay, so then I gave two arguments. One was the no miracles argument, which basically says, a bit more complicated than this, but it basically says that if you didn't have a realist account, then it would kind of be a miracle that these theories which speak about DNA or electrons or things like that actually actually work. And it's also a miracle that you can derive previous scientific, successful scientific theories in some kind of limit of the new theory. And then we finished talking about Eddington's fishy story. This is basically the idea that, look, you can only theorize about what you can measure. Right, so he gives this story about an ichthyologist who puts a net into the sea, brings up an assortment of fish, but the net has holes which are 2 inches wide. So according to him, there are no fish, there are no sea creatures smaller than 2 inches. But the point he's making here is that, you know, if there's no way of measuring it, then it can't be form part of our physical theory. All right, so if you look at the operational or sort of anti-realist approach, it kind of wants to treat the whole physical theory as like a black box, right? So it's kind of clear that there's some inputs, some variables that we can manipulate, and some outputs. And it should be sort of clear what the interpretation of these things are in order for that kind of theory to work. Right, so if our real physical world, so these kind of boxes theorists like to draw all the time. So theorists in quantum foundations, most of the operationalists I know in quantum foundations are theorists because they have to think of the world as made of black boxes like this. This is a real black box. The reason we call these black boxes, by the way, is because engineers really make black boxes that you plug into your computer and stuff like that. Okay, But there's a problem with this, which is that if you go and look at an actual physics experiment, it looks more like this. This is a very messy, looks like a very messy system. This is actually, just out of interest, this is the equipment for one of the detectors that was used in the first loophole-free Bell experiment in 2015. That's what it looks like. So the thing is, this isn't a black box. In order to even interpret what's going on in this experiment, you need to know something about the theory of lasers, right? So there are various things in here. There are lasers, there are loads of optical elements, beam splitters, lenses, all kinds of things. And in order to even interpret what's going on in that experiment, you have to assume a lot of theory. You basically have to know how quantum optics works, and we have to assume that this is a roughly correct description of this experiment to even interpret what's going on. So is there really an instruction manual for what to do in the lab that the operationalists can rely on? Well, no, you require a lot of specialist knowledge of the theory. And so this is sort of known as the theory-ladenness of experiment in the philosophical literature. I can't really construct an experiment without assuming that a whole bunch of previous theories of physics are actually true. So there seems to be a problem here. All right, so so where are we? Okay, so first of all, it's undeniable that, as Eddington says, that what we can measure affects what we can theorize about, right? So Bertrand Russell gives a famous example of an unscientific concept, which is called Bertrand Russell's teacup, okay? So what he imagines is that on the other side of the sun to the Earth, there's a teacup, and that teacup doesn't interact with any of the known forces, has no gravitational force, no electromagnetic force, doesn't interact in any way, but that nevertheless, that teacup's there. He gives that as an example of an unscientific concept, because of course, there's absolutely no way that that could play any role in your scientific, I mean, it may be true, but it's not certainly not a scientific truth, right? Obviously, something like that can't play a role in any of our physical theories. So the anti-realist insists that what we can measure is primary. It's also undeniable that if you look at this kind of setup, you need our theorists to define or even interpret what we can measure. So a realist would say, no, your theory tells you what you can measure, right? Your theory tells you how to interpret what you can measure. And an anti-realist in particular is going to have a very hard time explaining how we can redefine concepts based on different measurements, right? So the meter, for instance, was originally defined by some particular rod that lived in the Bureau of Weights and Measurements in Paris, right? The length of that rod was the meter. These days, it's defined as the distance that light travels in a certain amount of time, right? So it's defined in terms of fundamental constants. If you're an operationalist, where everything's supposed to boil down to a procedure for what to do in the lab, those are two fundamentally different things. So when we change the definition of the meter, we've changed the concept. But the reason why we changed it in that way, of course, is that our theories tell us that measuring it according to the distance that light travels in a certain period of time is more accurate, a more accurate measurement of the same concept. How is the anti-realist, how is the operationalist going to make sense of the idea that one thing is more accurate than the other when the concept of a meter was, well, the concept of length was defined by the procedure of measuring it in the first place? So that's obviously a problem. All right, so what's really going on in my view? Yeah.
So I don't understand why that's a problem for the anti-realist.
It's a problem for the operationalist in particular, because an operationalist insists the concept of length has no meaning other than via a procedure for measuring it. Okay, so if I want to define for you if I want to define for you what does length mean, I have to say, okay, here's what you would go do in the lab to measure a length. And on the original definition of the meter, you would say, okay, you take this rod from Paris and you say, see how many of those are in a particular span the object that you're trying to measure, right? And so that's your definition. That's your very definition of length, because I don't have a definition of length. It's not that there's some sort of intuitive primary concept of length, and then we develop methods for measuring it. It's literally that length is the procedure for measuring it, right? So when I change the procedure for measuring it, in particular, if I change the procedure for, I mean, so there are all kinds of assumptions that go into the idea that having a meter rule is a good way of measuring length. One is like the homogeneity of space. So the idea that that ruler doesn't change length when I move it around in space, right? And also, you know, pre-relativity, if you defined the possible ways that you could measure a length with this rod, it would be different than post-relativity. Pre-relativity, you'd say, well, if my rod is moving along at some velocity relative to me, I can still use it to measure lengths in my frame of reference. Whereas post-relativity, you'd say, no, there's length contraction, so I can't use it that way. It has to be stationary with respect to me, right? So, So depending on what you say are the valid ways of measuring a length, that defines, according to the operationalist, the concept of length. And, you know, so in particular, if I allowed the rod to be moving along with a certain velocity, I would be defining a concept of length that's not really compatible with relativity, for instance. When we redefine length by saying that it's the distance traveled by the speed of light in a certain period of time, we are basically, well, according to the operationalist, that's a completely different thing. But what we've really done is we're using our physical theories, right? So we're using relativity to assert that that's going to be a really good way of measuring length, right? So assuming relativity is true. And an operationalist doesn't really want to rely on the physical theories themselves for defining, you know, the operationalist wants to have a sort of theory-independent notion of what the experimental procedure for measuring something is. So that seems to be a problem here. And it gets worse, you know, if you think about measuring time, the procedure for measuring time has undergone huge changes, right? So currently we measure it, the most accurate measurements of time based on atomic clocks, so the transition rate in a particular atom. And in order to determine that that's a good measure of time, you need a lot of physics, a lot of quantum mechanics in particular, right? But, you know, go back a couple of centuries and all we had was sundials. And if you're an operationalist, those kind of measurements seem to be completely different things, defining completely different things. Does this make sense? Somewhat. Okay. We can talk about that a bit more afterwards. Anyway, what I'm trying to get at here is that obviously both these effects are true. What we can measure affects what we can theorize about, but also we have to use our theories to define or interpret what we can measure. So insisting that either of these are primary isn't really helpful. Really, we have something like a bootstrap. This terminology comes from computer science. It's what your computer does when you turn it on, right? You have to load a little bit of code to do something so that you have enough code to load next bit of code, et cetera. Right, so we kind of go around in a cycle. And the point is, where does this cycle stop? Right, so at some point, if you think about the concept of time, you know, human beings had some kind of intuitive concept of time. That's where we started. We didn't start with a very precise notion. We started with the intuitive notion of time passing. Then we came up with ways of trying to measure trying to measure that. Based on that, we came up with theories that told us what are better ways to measure time, etc. And we go round and round. And the concept becomes more precise as we go around. Okay. So to give the example of time again, you know, as I said, you know, a couple of centuries ago, we only really had sundials to measure time. Those were good for the position of the sun in the sky is good for measuring time up to the order of an hour. It's not going to do you much good to accurately measure time down to the second. So when Galileo was noticing that pendulums seemed to swing regularly, how did he do it? The way he did it was he checked his pulse. So he compared the swing of the pendulum to the pulse and noticed it was regular. If you're an operationalist, you'd have to say, oh, well, Galileo was treating his pulse as the definition of the measurement of time, which is clearly ridiculous because he would have known even then that the rate of his pulse compared to his intuitive notion of how much time is passing is changes depending on what's going on. But he noticed that the swing of the pendulum was pretty regular, and so then clocks were based on that. And then Newtonian mechanics comes along and explains, in the concept of time that we have in Newtonian mechanics, I can derive that these pendulums are regular, right? So now we have a theoretical backing for it. We kind of bootstrap our way up. We bootstrap our way up around this cycle. okay, so what I want to argue is that neither of these two things are primary, and I really personally don't. I view both the realist and anti-realist position as containing some element of the truth, but neither of them should be taken as the end of the story. So how do we reconcile what we have? So I'm personally some kind of pragmatist. I'm calling this Leiferian pragmatism because I don't know if anybody's actually, probably somebody has in the philosophy literature stated exactly this position, but I just don't know about it because I'm not a philosopher. But anyway, pragmatism is just the idea that truth is somehow equal to utility, right? So what's true is what's useful. I'm not going to go that far because that's a pretty extreme position, but I think it is part of the story. So what I'm going to say is that at least part of what distinguishes a scientific truth from other types of knowledge, so I'm not going to rule out the fact that maybe there are other kinds of knowledge that are non-scientific, is that it is useful, right? So scientific truths have to have pragmatic value, even though they may have other things, right? So it can be useful in the sense that it allows us to make correct predictions, provides us with explanations. Explanations are useful things. Leads us to new experiments that we wouldn't have thought of otherwise. Even if it doesn't change the predictions, maybe the concept leads us to think of a different experiment. Could lead to the development of new technologies or allow us to generalize a theory beyond its current scope. So we may, for example, have an interpretation of quantum mechanics which doesn't make a single different prediction from quantum mechanics, but suggests a new way to come up with a theory of quantum gravity. That theory gets tested and is successful, woohoo, then I would say that was a useful idea, even though it doesn't change quantum mechanics at all. So I want quite a broad notion of what it means for something to be useful. So part of the concept of a scientific truth is that it should be useful. It's part of the concept, it may not be the full concept. So let's look at realism. Well, you don't have to be a realist to realize that realist explanations are often very useful in science. So if I have a theory which has a story about what kinds of things exist and how they behave, then I have a framework for thinking about the theory. It provides me an explanatory framework for the theory. It's going to be easier for me to reason about new physical situations, and it's going to be easier to think about how to generalize the theory because I'm going to be thinking about how do I generalize those things, the behavior of those things that are supposed to exist. Even if you don't buy that, it's certainly interesting that every physical theory you can think of prior to quantum theory, all of classical physics, all of relativity, admits a realist account. So even if you don't, so So maybe you don't believe that they're true because you're an anti-realist, but there's a difference, right? It seems that all these other theories emit a realist account, even if I don't believe it. In quantum mechanics, it seems that I'm being pushed towards the anti-realist account by the lack of a realist one. So you should be interested in why that's true. Might give you a better argument for anti-realism if you find out why that's true. So the question of why can't we find a realist account that we all agree on for quantum theory is going to be an interesting one, regardless of which position you take, regardless of how seriously you take it. Similarly, you don't have to be an operationalist to realize that, you know, the realist account is very demanding. The realist account says, tell me what things exist, tell me how they behave, and explain everything in terms of that. That's very demanding. Sometimes stepping back from that and temporarily defining things in terms of things we can do in the lab is useful, particularly when you want to change the nature of reality, when your theory has to change the nature of reality. Okay, so if we consider Einstein's derivation of special relativity, he realizes that the two postulates he are going to be incompatible with the Newtonian notion of space and time, right? How am I going to change the notion of space and time when everything that I have in my theory is based on it? So what he does is he steps back from the realist account and he at least temporarily redefines the notions of space and time in terms of readings on clocks and length measurements that he does by bouncing light off things and things like that. And from that derives the new structure of space-time. Yeah?
What would the position of realism versus anti-realism on emergent properties or effective particles like photons?
Okay, so this gets into the philosophical weeds a bit. So there are, of course, different varieties of realism. But on the most straightforward account, realism says, okay, there's some kind of fundamental ontology, something that exists, and some laws for how it behaves. Now, emergent properties have to be defined in terms of that. So they may only be approximately definable in terms of that, that thing. But you should be able to identify something in the theory which corresponds to it. You should be able to reduce the emergent property to the fundamental ontology somehow. And this is kind of what goes on in so people who like the Everett many worlds account have to derive the classical world from a unitarily evolving wave function. Unitarily evolving wave function, of course, looks nothing like our classical world. So they have to say that that's an emergent property. And we'll see a bit of that later. So some people view Einstein as an operationalist because of his derivation of special relativity. What I think he was actually doing was he stepped out into an operational methodology. Once he's derived the structure of space-time, he goes back to the realist point of view. He just says, like, this is the structure of space-time. We've derived it. Right? That's what it is. That's what really exists. But he's using an operational methodology because he has to radically change the nature of things that exist. So he steps back from the realist program. Thermodynamics is, of course, also an operational theory. It speaks of things like heat engines and work and heat transfer and things like that. It doesn't speak of the fundamental ontology of the particles. But if you tried, you know, if you tried to develop thermodynamics directly from Newtonian mechanics without first having that operational structure to hit the target with statistical mechanics, you'd have had a tough job, right? So thermodynamics was a useful step, but it's still useful, of course, and then it gives us the target to shoot at when we try and derive it from statistical mechanics. So the operational implications of quantum theory are, in fact, the only part that we all agree upon. So it might be useful to formulate quantum theory operationally in different ways. And we've seen some of that in the first week, you know, when I was talking about string diagrams and all this kind of stuff. These are different ways of expressing the operational content of quantum theory. Perhaps they give you different insights into what the theory is about. Okay, so we can be free to use realist terminology and, methods, or operationalist terminology and methods. Both of them might be useful in helping to further understand quantum theory. All right, so now what I'd like to do is, if you remember at the beginning, last week I gave you this Feynman quote where he says, you know, I'm not sure what the problem is. So now I'd like to, with the background that we have, try and define the problem. Yes.
I'm wondering, how do you think about participatory realism?
Well, participatory realism, in this terminology, I would say it's a variety of anti-realism, because it basically denies the existence of stuff that's independent of observers. So obviously within, and I also know that some of the participants, some of the, I mean, you can tell from the terminology, participatory realism, that many of the proponents of that hate the label anti-realism. So you have to be a bit careful. But at least in the way I'm talking about it, it goes on the anti-realist side.
Yeah, but I think they do not really believe in anti-realism. They think that it is a
capitalism. If you look at the list of things that went... See, it's a very sort of coarse divide here, right? As I say, like, within the philosophy of science, there's at least those people who look at quantum mechanics. Most of them are very sort of hardcore realists. So they would just call everything that doesn't correspond to their sort of hardcore version of realism anti-realist in some way, throw some label of positivism or whatever. But yes, of course, we have to understand that there are very much more finer gradations between different notions of real. It's a spectrum or a whole field of possibilities rather than being like really a simple dichotomy. So at least in the way I'm talking in these lectures, that idea isn't compatible with the kind of realism I'm talking about here. But I understand that some of the proponents of that call it a type of realism. Okay, does that make sense? These issues are obviously very fraught, as you can see. Okay, so let's try and define the problem. So remember, like a lot of people historically have said that the problem is the measurement problem. Every interpretation, however, solves the measurement problem, so that can't be the problem. Let's try and define the, and also remember the measurement problem was a problem with the orthodox interpretation. So what I want to try and do is define the problem in something that's more of a interpretation independent way. Come up with some criteria that I think that all interpretations should try and fulfill. So here's my attempt at doing it. So the problem is, if quantum theory is an approximately correct theory of physics, well, we know that it's going to have to be superseded. It may have to be superseded at some point, but we know it's a very good approximation. If that's true, then what kinds of things exist and how should they behave? That's what question one. How do they save the phenomena? I'm going to go through this in a bit more detail. And then the third part is to do so in such a way that leads to progress in physics. That's the problem in a nutshell. So let's go through these three points. So what kind of things exist and how do they behave? This is call this the ontology question. So ontology is the study of what exists. So this question asks, what's the ontology underlying quantum theory? So note here that this question should be interpreted in the following way. We're not asking what actually exists in the world, because the world might not be exactly described by quantum theory. What we're asking is a question like, suppose quantum theory were an exactly true theory of physics, what kinds of things would exist in that world? Just as if you ask, suppose electromagnetism is, consider a world in which classical electromagnetism is the true physical theory, you would say, electrons exist, electromagnetic fields exist, and they obey these equations, right? So this is this kind of statement we're looking for. So it more has to do with the internal explanatory structure of the theory. What are the entities in the theory that are doing the role of explaining what we see, rather than the actual physical world? Also, although this seems like a very realist question, it doesn't actually assume realism. A valid answer to this question would be only measurement outcomes exist. That would be an anti-realist position. That's a valid answer to this question, but you also have to answer the other two questions. So question two is to save the phenomena. This is a philosophical terminology for a very simple concept. The idea is that what we see in our experiments needs to be explained in terms of the answer to question one, right? So once I've said what exists and how does it behave, I need to explain what I actually see in terms of that. And this could be a long and convoluted story that involves emergence, just to do back to that, but there needs to be some sort of story. So in particular, we need to explain why we observe things with the Born rule probabilities. So that's one part of it. But we also need to explain the emergence of the classical world in terms of the things that exist, not just in terms of equations, but I have to say the things that exist somehow give rise to the appearance of reality. So if I have an ontology where there are particles that have positions, then in this lecture theater, there should be a bunch of particles forming that desk over there. And if there isn't, I haven't done a good job of explaining the actual world. Okay, so you could have an answer to question one, and a valid answer to question one would be to say, there's a bunch of green aliens running around on Mars, and that's what quantum theory is about, because question one has no constraints to it. But you would be hard-pressed to explain, to save the phenomena in terms of those green aliens running around on Mars. So that constrains us to something that's actually playing a useful explanatory role. That's it. And then this one would be much more controversial. So this comes from my pragmatism. So we want to do so in a way that leads to progress in physics. So most people who study quantum foundations would agree that these two questions are the ones that we have to solve. Some people view the interpretation of quantum mechanics as more of a branch of philosophy, and what they want to do is come up with a correct interpretation of quantum mechanics that then allows them to just be happy. The goal is just to make them happy. You know, they'll sit at the top of the mountain meditating with their newfound enlightenment once they found the correct interpretation of quantum mechanics. So that's one goal that you might have. But the reason why I study it is that I think it's going to lead to progress in physics. And I think in some ways this is the only way that you can resolve the interpretation question, because remember what I said, a scientific truth has to have some pragmatic cash value. Means it has to be useful for something. So if we have different interpretations of quantum mechanics that have no relative benefits in utility relative to each other, then we can't say that they're scientific truths. So if you think this is a scientific question, then you ought to be trying to do three. So the question is now, how are we going to know which is the correct interpretation? Well, it has to have some utility. It could make a prediction that conflicts with standard quantum theory and subsequently confirmed. It could allow us to generalize quantum theory beyond its current scope. So maybe it completely agrees with quantum theory everywhere where we know about it, but allows us to find a theory of quantum gravity in a way that wasn't suggested by standard quantum theory. Or it could sort of simply provide better explanations, right? If you have a theory which has great explanations in it, then somebody who's using those explanations is going to be able to work with that theory much more quickly, derive new predictions much, much better than somebody who's confused about the theory, right? So the idea is that once we find the correct answer to these questions, in order for it to actually be the correct answer, it should be so obvious that everybody will jump on it and say, yeah, that's the right way of doing it, because it's so useful. Okay, so this would be controversial, but this is the high standard that I aim at, and this is the main reason why my current answer to the question, what is the correct interpretation of quantum mechanics, is none of the above, right? Because I don't think any of the interpretations we have right now really satisfy this kind of criterion. So, everybody clear on what the question is that we're trying to answer? Any questions about the questions? All right, so that took more time than I thought it was going to, unfortunately. So now I'm going to move on to the next section, which is the idea of epistricted theories. Well, I'm going to give you one example of one, which is a toy model due to Rob Speckens. here at Perimeter Institute. And the aim of this isn't to try and give you a full interpretation of quantum mechanics, but to show you what the benefits of a certain style of interpretation would be. So this is a realist interpretation that is also psi epistemic. It has the quantum state being a state of knowledge. So what we're ultimately going to do, and we may not get to this till next time, but we're ultimately going to try and go through the examples of potentially puzzling quantum phenomena that we talked about last week and show how each of them would be explained in this type of model. Okay, so we're not going to try and reproduce quantum theory, but we're going to create a sort of toy universe that has the same, some of the same kind of phenomena. All right, so setup of the toy theory, well, I already said that. It's psi epistemic, local, and non-contextual. The precise meanings of these terms I will introduce later in the week. Now, some versions of this theory actually reproduce some sub-theories of quantum theory. So in particular, in these examples, if you don't know what they are, don't worry. But the point is that, if I take quantum theory and I restrict to some certain sub-collection of states and measurements and operations, not the full quantum theory, but just some sub-theory, then some versions of this theory are actually accurate models for that. Turns out that the simplest version of this theory, the sort of toy bits version, doesn't exactly correspond to any part of quantum theory. It's just qualitatively similar. That's the one I'm going to deal with because it's the simplest one to deal with. But if you want to know how this corresponds to actual quantum theory, then you can look at these other papers. All right, so the idea of this kind of theory is that we're going to impose an epistemic restriction on how much we can know about a physical system. Okay, so the simplest way of stating this, and there are much more sophisticated ways of constructing this for the more for the other theories I talked about, but what we're going to use here is the idea that when you know as much as you can possibly know, you know as much about the system as you don't know. This is called the knowledge balance principle. Okay, so let's apply this. So let's suppose I have some system which has four possible states. You can think about, for example, a ball that can be in one of four boxes. So if you imagine the coordinate axes are here, this says the ball is in the positive x direction and the positive y direction. This one says it's positive x and negative y, etc. Right. So that's the idea behind the labeling of these four states. Okay. But there are just four different distinct states that the system can be in. Now, in order to determine which of those four states you're in, you need to, if I'm only allowing you to ask yes/no questions, you need two of them, right? So you can ask, for example, is the first entry plus or minus? Is the second entry plus or minus? And then that boils you down to an individual state. But for a binary question, you need two of them. So the knowledge balance principle here says, we can know the exact answer to one such question in a pair, but once you know the answer to one of those questions, then you must be completely uncertain about the answer to the other one. Okay, so this is just a principle that's imposed ad hoc, that we can't know everything. In some ways, it's a little bit like the uncertainty principle. The uncertainty principle tells you that you can't know everything at the same time, but here we're thinking about this as just a classical restriction on the classical probabilities that we assign here. Okay, so there are six, there's going to be six epistemic states. Epistemic state just means probability distribution that are compatible with this principle. Here they are. And I'm going to use a suggestive notation with these curvy kets, because the idea is that these this probability distributions are somehow analogous to those states for a qubit. Okay, so what this means is dark blue means a 50% probability of being there. White means zero probability. Okay, so these are probability distributions, and you can see that if I have the answer to one question, so for the Z states here, I have the answer to the question, what's the parity, right? So if I think of these as plus one or minus one, and I multiply them together, say, is the product of those two bits plus one or minus one? And then if I have the answer to that question, then I have one of these two states, right? So for each of these, you can find a pair of binary questions where you know the answer to one of them and not the other one. You can also have a state of non-maximal knowledge where you don't know as much as you're allowed to. So if I took a 50-50 mixture of these two states, then so light blue here means 25% probability. This would somehow supposed to be analogous to the maximally mixed state in quantum mechanics. All right. Now let's think about measurements. So in order to extract information from our system, we're going to have to be able to do measurements. And we're going to demand two principles for our measurements. The first one is basically saying that they're going to be similar to ideal measurements in quantum theory. So we're going to demand that they should be repeatable. That means that they would yield the same result if we perform them twice in a row. If we do an ideal measurement with the projection postulate in quantum mechanics, we'd get that, so we're trying to model that here. And the other thing is, they shouldn't violate the knowledge balance principle. So after the measurement, the system has to be left in a valid epistemic state, should satisfy the knowledge balance principle. So this immediately implies that you can't have a measurement that reveals the exact ontic state, right? So if you knew the exact, so ontic state here just means the state of reality, so one of these four states. So because if I knew for certain that the state was this box, then this would be my probability distribution, and that violates the knowledge balance principle. But we can have measurements that reveal some coarse-grained information, and as a consequence of these two principles, we will determine that they have to disturb the ontic state of the system. Let's see how that works. So let's consider a coarse-grained measurement. So let's imagine that we have a measurement that just tells you whether you're on the right or the left. We call this an X measurement, suggestively. So it gives you an outcome plus one if the system is over here, and minus one if you're over here. Now let's imagine that we apply this measurement to the plus Y state. So this is the plus Y state. And let's suppose that we get the plus outcome. If we get the plus outcome, then you know that before the measurement, the state of the system must have been here. Okay, so you know now exactly which of the four states it was. That's going to violate the knowledge balance principle. So in order to save the knowledge balance principle and maintain repeatability, we have to make sure that the system gets disturbed by the measurement, right? So sometimes the state gets randomly disturbed. Now, in order to preserve repeatability, if I make the measurement again, I have to get the plus one outcome again. So the only two states that the system can possibly occupy after the measurement are either this one or that one, because those are the only ones that give me repeatability. So in order to preserve the knowledge balance principle, after the measurement, I need the state to be this. Okay. So what must happen? What must happen when I make the measurement is that for some reason, after I get the plus one outcome, with 50% probability, the state stays the same, and with 50% probability, it gets knocked down to here. So basically, with 50% probability, the state stays the same, and with 50% probability, those two states get swapped. Okay? So there's a disturbance, there's a sort of intrinsic disturbance that comes when you make a measurement. And if you do that, then your updated epistemic state after the measurement will be that, and it satisfies the knowledge balance principle, and everything's fine. So from that we can say, okay, so there's a number of valid measurements on a toy bit, right? So we can actually answer these three binary, different sets of binary questions. So I can have the X measurement, which I just described. I can have a Y measurement, basically tells me the Y position, and I can have a Z measurement, which is like this. And these states here are like the eigenstates. They play the role of the eigenstates of these measurements, because if the system starts in one of these two states and I make this measurement, then the epistemic state doesn't change, right? The probability distribution is the same after the measurement. Bear in mind that that doesn't mean that nothing changes, because when I make this measurement, whatever state I do it on, say I get the plus outcome, there's always a 50% probability that these two states get swapped. But the point is that this probability distribution is invariant under that. So that probability distribution doesn't change, although there's always a disturbance to the underlying quantic state of the system. OK, any questions about how measurements work? Yeah.
What do you mean when they get swapped for the eigenstate?
So what I mean is that whenever I do the x measurement and get the plus outcome, then what happens is always either nothing, right? So this stays here and this stays here, or that this goes down here and this goes down there. And this happens with probability a half, and this happens with probability a half. So whenever I do the x measurement and get the plus outcome, this happens. So this means that with 50% probability, the ontic state of the system actually changes. But since this probability distribution was already 50% here and 50% there, that probability distribution stays the same. So the epistemic state stays the same. It acts like an eigenstate. But the ontic state is changing. So the suggestion is here that something like this is going on in quantum mechanics. So you shouldn't think that because you shouldn't think that the eigenstate is, in the orthodox interpretation, the eigenstate is like really the state of reality. That's not happening here. Here, the eigenstate is epistemic. It's like a probability distribution. OK. So now let's talk about dynamics. So unitary dynamics in quantum theory is reversible, can be undone by another unitary. So we're going to look at reversible dynamics. And that's just going to be a permutation on the underlying ontic states. Once you know what the permutation on the ontic states is, you can compute what happens to these epistemic eigenstates, right? So for example, if I just cyclically permute the ontic states like this, then you can say, OK, well, if I start in this x state, if I'm here, I go down here. And if I'm here, I go there. So this one's going to get mapped to that one. So x gets mapped to y on the epistemic level, right? So we posit the dynamics at the level of the ontic states, and then we simply calculate what happens to those probability distributions. So this this kind of dynamics, basically, it switches x with y, and it switches plus with minus, leaves z alone, right? So you can find sort of analogs of unitary operations that you can actually do in quantum mechanics in this way, different permutations. So that's very simple. Now things get a little bit more complicated. Now we have to think about composite systems. So let's suppose we have two toy bits, right? So each toy, I'm going to label the first one A and the second one B. Each toy bit is really described by two bits, right? Plus or minus x, plus or minus y, plus or minus x, plus or minus y. So we have 16 possible ontic states now. So when you have 16 possible ontic states, it's going to take four yes-no questions to specify the exact ontic state. So the knowledge balance principle says you can know the answer to two of those yes-no questions. Now here's the subtlety. The knowledge balance principle is supposed to apply not only to the global system, but also to the individual subsystems. So if I marginalize over system A, I should get a valid toy bit state on system B, right? So so what I'm doing in these diagrams, so previously I drew the four ontic states for one system in a grid like this. So here I'm flattening it out, right? So this is plus, 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 minus, minus, plus, and plus, minus, minus for A. And up the column here, I've got other rows represent the B state, yeah.
I just have a question about the dynamics slide.
Yeah.
So could we do reversible dynamics that makes a permutation of the epistemic states that doesn't correspond to a permutation of the ontic states? Because it seemed like you should be able to.
So you can do permutations of the epistemic states that are not representable by permutations of the ontic states. But the point is, what we're trying to do here is develop a realist theory where all of the explanations are in terms of what happens to the ontic states. So we've got an explanation for what happens to the epistemic states, but I can't reduce that to this is what happens to the ontic states, then I don't really have a realist theory, right? So the idea here is we explain everything in terms of what's going on with the ontic states. So you certainly can find transformations in quantum mechanics that you cannot correctly represent here. And there's a good reason for that, which is that at the level of ontology, if I think of the ontic state as specifying the x and y coordinates, right? Because this tells me the outcome of an x measurement, this tells me the outcome of a y measurement, the second bit. Then in this theory, we have z is equal to xy, right? Because it's the parity of those two bits which tells me what z is. But in quantum mechanics, if you think about the Pauli observables, in the Pauli observables in quantum mechanics, it's not like that. It's sigma z is equal to like I sigma x sigma y. There's this complex phase. And this is the reason why this theory doesn't exactly reproduce the predictions of quantum mechanics, because of this phase factor here. So there's a difference in the structure. And so that's every failure of this theory to exactly reproduce quantum mechanics is basically down to that fact. Okay, where are we? We've got a bit of time left. Okay, so composite systems. Okay, so if we consider this state where you have 25% probability of being in each of these four ontic states, this satisfies the knowledge balance principle for the global system, but not for the local systems, because I know that system B is in exactly this state, right? And it has to be an equal mixture of two states. So this fails the knowledge balance principle, and this is not an allowed epistemic state in the theory. So now it gets a bit complicated to work out what exactly are the valid epistemic states. But here are some examples of valid ones. So these ones are basically like product states, because they're states in which one system is in a definite one of these eigenstates, and so is the other system. Just basically have an independent, uncorrelated probability distributions. So those are examples, but some of them are correlated. These are correlated states, different correlated states, and they're set up in such a way that if I marginalize over one system, right, so if I forget about the B degree of freedom, then you can see I have absolutely no knowledge of where A is. So that's allowed. And it's a bit like a maximally entangled state where when I have, where you know, I'm satisfying the knowledge balance principle, these are states of maximal knowledge. I have as much knowledge as I'm allowed, but all my knowledge is about the correlations between the two bits. I have no information about each individual toy bit on its own. So if I decide to have all my information about the correlations, then in order to satisfy the knowledge balance principle, I necessarily have to have no information about the individual bits. This is a bit like the fact that a maximally entangled state of two qubits has maximally mixed marginals. Okay, but this is here, this structure of correlation here, that's a that's a consequence of the knowledge balance principle. So these are supposed to be analogs of the entangled states. I'm putting entangled in quotes. They're obviously not quantum entangled states, but they're going to reproduce some of the puzzling features. Okay, so now another complication. What about dynamics on composite systems? So for an individual toy bit, dynamics just has to be a permutation. But now we need to preserve the knowledge balance principle for subsystems. So not all permutations of two toy bits are going to represent valid dynamics. So for example, if I consider this permutation, which just swaps these two states and swaps those two states, if I apply that to this analog of an entangled state, it would map me down to here, which is not a valid, epistemic state. So the dynamics that we have are going to be a subset of the permutations. And again, it's not hugely easy to work out what that subset is. So there is a, just as an aside, there is a bit of a more sophisticated formulation of these theories, which is in terms of discrete classical phase spaces. And then you can say that there's a, this is just an aside for people who know about this stuff. you can formulate these theories in terms of a symplectic structure on phase space, and then the valid permutations are going to be ones that preserve the symplectic structure. They're like canonical transformations in classical physics. They are exact in the discrete version of classical physics. So you can determine what all of these things are, but at the level that we're talking about it, what you would have to do is go through all the allowed epistemic states and check that they get mapped to valid epistemic states, which is quite a monumental task to do. All right. Okay, so let's see, 5 minutes? Yeah, 5 minutes. Okay, so let's start by explaining a couple of the things that were puzzling before. So let's consider the EPR paradox. So our analog of an entangled state is going to be a correlated state like this, okay? Now, if this were the explanation, then it resolves the EPR paradox in exactly the way that Einstein envisaged, right? So in this theory, the outcomes of all measurements are predetermined. The ontic state tells you exactly what the outcome of any measurement is going to be. Two systems are in an initially correlated state, so it's determined how they're correlated from the beginning, but they have an actual value for every measurement outcome. And the collapse of the wave function that happens is just an updating of your information followed by a local randomization of the system being measured. There's no non-locality here. What happens? If I measure XA of system A, then I'll either find that it's in one of these two states or one of those two states, because the B state isn't detected at all, so it's either over here and over here. And then when I find that, I will just randomize the other bit, the Y bit of A, right? So I'll just randomize between these two and between those two. But what happens here on the updating is completely independent of the state of B. It has no effect on the state of B, right? So you can see this thing acts in rows, does the same thing on each row. So it's not acting on B's toy bit at all. And in doing that, I get this, when I do that, so if I find the plus one outcome, then I'll know I'm here or here, then I'll go down to here, and so I'll go down to the product state, just as in the EPR experiment. And the same thing would happen if I made a Y measurement, or if I made a Z measurement. I'd get perfect correlations between the two, and there's nothing mysterious going on. It's just predetermined at the beginning how these things are correlated. So that's the kind of explanation of the EPR paradox that Einstein hoped we would have. Okay, so the EPR is not particularly a puzzle. Let's also look at two other things probably. So we have the non-uniqueness of mixed state decompositions. So remember, the maximally mixed state is just represented by a situation where I have 25% probability of being in all four ontic states. And if I prepare the plus x state or the minus x state with probability a half each, that's what I'll get. If I prepare the same thing for the y states, I get that as well. And if I prepare the same thing for the z states, I get that as well, right? So in quantum theory, some people regard it as puzzling that a mixed state has different decompositions into pure states. But that's happening here, and the reason why that can happen is that this theory is psi epistemic. It means that the ontic state doesn't determine the state of reality. So you see here, if the system's in this ontic state, it could be because I'm in the plus x, I prepared the plus x state, or it could be because I prepared the plus y state, or it could be because I prepared the plus z state. So the eigenstate, if you like, because that's an epistemic state, isn't determined by the actual state of reality, they overlap. And because you have this overlapping, you can have that mixtures of different epistemic states give you the same thing, just like this. Okay, so that makes that a little bit more understandable. Another thing is just the indistinguishability of quantum pure states. So in quantum mechanics, if I prepare two non-orthogonal quantum states, then there's no measurement I can do that will tell me which is which, with certainty. Otherwise, I'm going to make some error. So let's look at two of these things that are supposed to represent pure states in the toy theory, plus x and plus y. They overlap here, right? So regardless of whether I prepare plus x or plus y, with probability a half, I'm going to get the same state of reality. If you pop that system into a measuring device, then there's no way it can tell a difference. Like if the measuring device, even if the measurement device could tell exactly the ontic state, right, then there's no way that it would be able to tell between these two with certainty, because with 50% probability, they both give exactly the same state of reality. Okay, so the idea is that a natural explanation for why you can't distinguish different pure quantum states is if they're somehow more analogous to overlapping probability distributions. Okay, I think we're probably out of time. But are there any questions about either? We'll look at a couple more of these explanations next time, but are there any questions about this theory at all? Nope. If not, I will see you tomorrow.